Thank you, Jerry. And before I begin, I just want to remember a dear friend of many of us we've just lost 2 days ago, Anita Roddick. And before I came here, I was very fortunate to join the group of scientists and religious leaders who made this trip to the Arctic to witness the melting of the ice caps. And an entire way of life is being destroyed. You've seen the polar bears losing their ecological space. But the highest mobility in that part of the world is the dog sledge, and they can't use it. They're locked into their villages because the ice is now too thin to travel on it, but it's still there and therefore not good enough for them to use boats. The same melting is making the Himalayan glaciers in my region, the Ganges Glacier, recede by 30 meters a year. In 20 years' time, the Himalayan glaciers will have reduced from 500,000 square kilometers to 100,000 square kilometers. And given our rainfall patterns, in the hot summer season when we have a drought, it's only the melting of the glaciers that brings us water. So we are talking about one-fifth of humanity, 20 to 30 years from now, having no water in the grand rivers around which the grand civilizations of Asia have been built. And where did this start? You know, I mean, all this felt so timeless. And it started with humanity getting at the fossil fuel, which was never supposed to be touched. It wasted through pollution, and that's the carbon dioxide we are seeing, but it also wasted people. The wasted people of Europe could move to the Americas, to Australia, to Africa, but that model carries on. And globalization is now industrializing every activity of every human being's life across the planet. For me, globalization is really expanding the use of fossil fuel. And so while on the one hand, when we talk climate change, we are talking reducing emissions, the entire economic model is based on increasing emissions. It's based on increasing emissions by destroying small-scale peasant farming and introducing large-scale industrial agriculture. It's increasing emissions by making every one of us dependent on our everyday needs to come from China. Including little, you know, in India we're crazy. We have 300 million divinities, a Ganesh and a Hanuman and a Guru Nanak. And the other day they suddenly found Guru Nanak, who's the founding Sikh guru, chinky-eyed. You know, they just changed Confucius and put a turban on his head. And there was a huge riot in Punjab. Everything today is being made where it can be made most cheaply, which means where resources can be exploited the fastest and workers can be exploited the highest. And at one level, that's what's being reflected in China's double-digit growth and India's 9% growth. It's basically converting our resources into commodities to be sold around the world. But that conversion requires the wastage of human beings on a scale we've never seen. In India right now, the relocation of industry, for example, industry like steel that's shutting down in Europe and America is relocating to India. Automobile companies that are shutting down in the West are moving to India. They're talking about making 50 million cars in India annually. Only 4% of India will ever own them. The rest will either be exported, or that 4% will have 8 cars rather than 2. Already my landlord has 5 in a family of 3. Those cars need minerals. They need steel. They need iron ore mining, they need aluminium, they need bauxite mining, and every inch of the land in India is today serving a global fossil fuel economy that's on fast forward. It needs land. Land grab is the biggest resource crisis. Land you can't create. You can only exhaust. But peasants are saying we will not move. That's what they said in Nandigram. 25 were shot dead, and they refused to move. In Dadri, where women were raped and attacked, they refused to move. In place after place, the tribals, the peasants in India are saying, this is our land, this is our mother, this is where we will be. And when the money for compensation becomes bigger and bigger, I love this action. The Nandigram peasants sent a letter to the chief minister to say, how much is your mother for sale? How much will you take for her? Because this land is our mother. And the globalization of agriculture has really become genocidal. It's hugely responsible for increasing greenhouse gases, whether it's from the nitrogen fertilizers or the fossil fuel in the mechanical energy that's used or in the long-distance transport and food miles. But on the ground, it's killing people. Long before it'll kill us through climate change, it's killing people, physically killing people. 150,000 farmers have been pushed to end their lives in India because of Monsanto seed monopolies, where Monsanto was collecting 2,400 rupees as royalty for a kilogram of BT cotton seed they were selling for 3,200 rupees. They're in the courts right now. We've challenged them. We joined one of the state governments. They're saying we have a right to this monopoly. And we are saying this: our country has never given you this right. They assume they got it in the United States, and therefore they have it everywhere, whether the law allows it or not. Or Cargill, wanting to grab India's wheat market, having signed an agreement through the Bush administration with right here in the city, decisions about agriculture are being made here in Washington, a two-year-old agriculture agreement. So Cargill eventually got India's wheat markets opened up, and the international wheat price is $400. Indian farmers are getting $200. And this double price is ultimately a subsidy that we are giving in addition to the subsidy your farm bill is providing to these corporations. Retail, India's a huge, huge land of bazaars, of hearts, of markets. Every street is a market. Hawkers come down in the morning, get us our vegetable to our doorstep. Of course, that's not very good for Walmart, so they're manipulating zoning laws, shutting down hawkers, shutting down businesses in town, so that we will have a Walmart model. But that means 100 million people out of retail, and we don't know how much more carbon emissions while Walmart talks about going green. I think John has done some calculation, but you need to add the additional emissions. We've done it for what it would mean for a few hundred stores. But Walmart, you know, we just had a wonderful action in Chandni Chowk, which is one of our oldest markets, because Walmart had announced that in 10 years' time, they'll generate 5,000 jobs. They're job creators. 100 million jobs in retail. Not jobs given by someone else, but self-employment, livelihoods. So here you have globalization adding to emissions, and it needs to be a continued part of our work. And you've got false solutions that were laid out by Jed. But the two false solutions that I think we need to pay particular attention to is the dominant solution in terms of carbon trading. Because at the philosophical level, at the worldview level, it's the second privatization of the atmospheric commons. The first privatization was putting the pollution into the atmosphere beyond the Earth's recycling capacity. Now, with carbon trading, the rights to the Earth's carbon recycling capacity are gravitating exactly into the hands of the polluters. The environmental principle used to be the polluter must pay. Carbon trading is transforming that into the polluter gets paid. Stern, who did the Stern Review, has clearly said it is an allocation of a full set of property rights to the atmosphere. And PricewaterhouseCoopers, who was very notorious in trying to privatize, with the World Bank help, Delhi's water supply, and we defeated them 2 years ago in that project, has said that trade in carbon emissions is equated with the transfer of similar rights, such as copyrights, patents, licensing rights, commercial and industrial standards. One of the things we've always said in IFG is the enclosures of the commons is one of the deep crises of resource depletion. Once resources move out of common management and public care, they will get further degraded. And if you really look at the clean development mechanism, it's all about dirty industry. It's about HCFC plants being accelerated, new plants being set up in China and India. The biggest recipients of CDM credits in China and India are plants that are depleting the ozone layer. Sponge iron plants coming up in the tribal belts of India, in Chhattisgarh, Jharkhand, and Orissa. And clean seems to have become such a confusing word. We would have thought we know what clean is. And suddenly, everything dirty is clean, including nuclear. Nuclear not just as nuclear power, but nuclear as strategic use of nuclear power. I don't know how many of you have followed that the United States signed an agreement with India. Now, it isn't really that the United States signed an agreement with India, because you did not sign that agreement and I did not sign that agreement. Our prime minister came here, and at the same time they handed over our agriculture to Monsanto, Cargill, and Walmart, who sit in the board of the agriculture agreement. They also signed this nuclear agreement, which has led to the Hyde Act. Section 103 of the Hyde Act calls for securing India's full and active participation in U.S. efforts to dissuade, isolate, and if necessary, sanction and contain Iran if it proceeds with its nuclear program. Iran has been mentioned 15 times in a bilateral agreement. So the nuclear agreement with India is definitely not about clean energy. It is about something bigger. And in India, right now, while I'm here, we are having the biggest democratic mobilization against this agreement. First, because Parliament did not clear it. Second, because we don't want to be a client state of the empire. We want our non-alignment defended. And thirdly, we don't want a $100 billion market created for the defense industry in the United States. After all, you are going to have a big mobilization tomorrow against the war, and we don't want to be part of US's wars without end. We are, after all, the land of Gandhi, the land of nonviolence, the land of peace, the land of ahimsa. As Simon said, we have to begin with solutions where we are, while we defend our democratic rights. I work primarily on agriculture. The globalized, industrialized agriculture is a very big part of the pollution that we are dealing with, a very big part of the crisis we are facing. But ecological, biodiverse, local agriculture is part of the solution, both in reducing emissions, in increasing absorption of carbon, and most importantly, providing the adaptive capacity to deal with climate chaos. This year in Navdanya, the movement I started for seed saving, we started saving seeds that can deal with the drought, that can deal with the floods. We've been saving seeds that can deal with the cyclones and hurricanes, and distributed those seeds after the tsunami. Those seeds are available They merely have to be saved and distributed rapidly enough before Monsanto comes up with yet another false solution that without genetic engineering and seed patterns, we will not be able to respond to climate change. For those of you who are interested, at the South End desk, there is this most recent report I've done, which is very simply soil, not oil. Our solutions for agriculture. And South End also has a work that many of us have been involved in, many from IFG, Jerry, Debbie, the International Commission on the Future of Food, and it's the manifestos on the future of seed and food. And I'm saying this so I don't have to go through all the details that are available in this. I just want to end by saying that we have basically two options. We have the option of letting the remaining resources of the planet be fought over viciously through militarized power. Or we can move rapidly to the ability to rebuild our ecosystems, share the limited resources the planet can provide us, and create good lives while doing it. But to do that, we'll have to get out of many reductionisms. The first reductionism being the reductionism of energy. We've suddenly moved to thinking of energy only as something we can consume, not as something we generate. And I think that generative concept of energy, we call it Shakti in India, is something we'll have to reclaim, because the solution to pollution and wasted people is bringing people back deep into the equation of how we produce things, how we work the land, how we shape community, and how we exercise our democratic rights and rebuild our freedoms. And of course, we'll have to get out of the mindsets that treat the laws manufactured by the market as immutable and unchanging. And the three concepts that are constantly referred to as something that can't be touched is economic growth. You can't make any change that will touch the 9% growth in India, the 10% growth in China. You cannot interfere in the unregulated market, even though every step of trade liberalization is an interference in the market. Every step of creating an opportunity for Cargill and Monsanto is an interference in the market. And the third false sacred is unbridled consumerism. We are because we buy, something that Jerry addressed. The problem of climate chaos to me, and the problem of appropriating the resources of those who need those resources for ecological security and economic security, is ultimately a question of ethics and justice. And that issue of ethics and justice can only be addressed if we recognize some very basic facts and reorient our practices of what we eat, what we do on our farms, our homes, our towns, our planet. We need to reinvent our eating and drinking, our moving and working in our local ecosystems and local cultures, enriching our lives while lowering our consumption without impoverishing others. And above all, we need to subject the laws that govern production and consumption to the laws of Gaia, the laws of the planet, the laws of a planet that can give forever in abundance for our needs, if we do not allow the narrow-minded, mechanistic, reductionist, greed-based system of industrialism, capitalism, globalization, to make us imagine that to be inhuman is the definition of being human. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Vandana. Our next speaker is David Corton, who has written several extremely important books, including When Corporations Rule the World, and most recently, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community, both of them bestsellers. He has worked for over 35 years in business, academia, international development institutions. He's the founder and the president of the People-Centered Development Forum, a global alliance dedicated to the creation of just, inclusive, and sustainable societies. He's the board chair of the Positive Futures Network, the publisher of Yes Magazine. David was once USAID. I'm looking for that in your bio here. He was a Ford Foundation project specialist in Manila and Asia, regional advisor on development management for the U.S. Agents for AID. So he's one of those great, rare turncoats that we love so much. And so he speaks with experience on both sides of the coin. So let's welcome Dave Korten. I think he's got a PowerPoint.
Hey, great to be here with all this energy. This is where I get my hope when I see all the folks who are out here ready to do the hard work. Good. We've got the PowerPoint. Well, we've had a lot of depressing news. Somehow we've got to get to the bottom before it gets better. And one of the things I love about Vandana is she's always kind of the turning point in our presentations where we begin to get to the action. Now, I know that you are here as I am because we like a good challenge. So you're getting the picture. We have quite a wonderful challenge before us. Now, if we're going to arise to that challenge, we have to get clear on why we're in the mess we're in, and we have to begin talking about bold solutions. And that's where I'm going to put my energy. Now, part of the good news is the debate is finally pretty much over. Even the doubters are beginning to recognize that we humans have a bit of a problem. We're just beginning as a society, and particularly as a nation, to wake up to the truth that the day of reckoning for our reckless human ways has arrived. The global warming, the end of cheap oil, species extinction, exhaustion of fresh water, spreading social disintegration, and pending financial collapse are all consequences of the monumental imbalances that we humans have created in our relationships with one another and with Earth. Overconsumption and overpopulation have placed our species in what system modelers call environmental overshoot, which means we have exceeded our environmental niche and are consuming the Earth's life support systems faster than they can regenerate. Extreme inequality is unraveling the social fabric as competition for resources intensifies. And dependence on a cheap oil subsidy leaves us with an obsolete physical and institutional infrastructure. So you might say we've got a bit of a problem. It is a true test of our creativity. We have to invent ourselves as a species and as a society. The choices that we humans make over the next 5 to 10 years will determine whether the inevitable correction plays out as a suicidal last man standing competition for the last of Earth's remaining resources. And I realize I'm using sexist language here, but this brutal competition really is a kind of a guy thing. Or whether it's going to play out as a cooperative sharing of Earth's abundance to secure the health of all the world's children, families, communities, and natural systems for generations to come. Yes, of course, it is important to change our light bulbs and to increase our car mileage. But in the larger context, this is tinkering at the margin. It will not save us. And as Jerry has so aptly noted, green shopping and carbon trading are basically diversions. Biofuels are mostly counterproductive. In fact, most of the establishment's proposed solutions are actually designed to affirm and strengthen the existing system of dominator power and elite rule. None come close to solving the problem, perhaps in part because in large measure the problem is the existing system of dominator power and elite rule. Nothing is going to save us short of fundamentally redefining our human relationships with one another and with Earth. It is a worthy challenge with deep historical roots that extend back 5,000 years to the time when our ancestors put aside the more egalitarian and gender-balanced ways of many earlier human societies and made a tragic turn from the partnership relations of Earth community, symbolized here by the Stonehenge Circle of Life, to the dominator relations of empire, symbolized here by the Egyptian pyramids of power. And as the era of empire took hold, female gods were replaced by male gods, and we humans lost our sense of attachment to Earth as the masculine drove out the feminine. Conquest became the measure of human greatness, and societies became divided between the rulers and ruled as relationships at all levels, from those among nations to those among family members, came to be organized by dominator hierarchy. So why is this important now? Because we still live in the era of empire, and every empire in the human experience has exhibited three characteristics. First, empires build their economies on a foundation of slavery or its equivalent. The division of society between extreme privilege and extreme deprivation pits every individual into an inexorable competition for any position of relative power and privilege. Second, empires expropriate a major portion of available resources to support the military forces, prisons, palaces, temples, retainers, and propagandists required to secure the hierarchy of power. The fact that more than half of current U.S. federal government discretionary spending goes to the military, and that's even before the horrendous costs of Iraq and Afghanistan, is just one indication of how little has changed over the last 5,000 years. Third, empires all too often elevate the most power-hungry and ethically challenged to the highest positions of power, because these are the most ruthless competitors and best express the values of the dominator system. Perhaps some contemporary examples come to mind. Over the millennia, the primary institutional form of empire has morphed from the imperial city-states of ancient time to the imperial nation-states of the modern era, and more recently to the imperial global corporations that now dominate so much of modern life. The underlying pattern of domination, alienation, and exclusion, however, has remained largely unchanged throughout this 5,000 years of empire. That pattern must now change because empire has finally reached the limits of exploitation and exclusion that people and planet will tolerate. To have a human future, we must expose the myths of the imperial economy and spread the good news of the possibilities of the new economy that is within our human means to birth. The very legitimacy of the imperial global economy rests on three sacred myths. And here is the essence of a familiar story we must expose and change. Economic growth is the essential path to human prosperity and progress. Because growth depends on wealthy people who have the means to invest, inequality is necessary, just, and beneficial for all. And financial markets direct investment to its most powerful use and reward investors in proportion to their individual contribution to growing new wealth for all. Isn't that a nice story? It is, of course, one of the big lies of our time. Just since 1970, global economic output has tripled, which has made a great deal of money for a few people. Now, during this very same period, the Living Planet Index, which is a measure of the health of the world's freshwater, ocean, and land-based ecosystems. This, of course, is the life support system of the planet and arguably the foundation of all real wealth, has declined by 30%. Bottom line, GDP growth tells us we are getting richer, when in fact, as a species, we are growing poorer by the day. During the 30 years that I worked as a member of the International Development Establishment, I gradually came to realize, to my deep horror, that much of what we call development is in fact a process by which the land and water resources on which the majority of the world's people depend for their often modest livelihoods are expropriated to make way for dams, mines, shrimp farms, fish ponds, agricultural estates, golf courses, suburban sprawl, shopping centers, et cetera, to support the already often extravagantly wasteful lifestyles of those already better off. At the same time, most of those displaced are reduced to utter devastation. In short, Conventional economic growth indicators measure the rate at which the productive resources of the poor are being expropriated by the rich to be converted to garbage at an accelerating rate in the promotion of consumerism to make money for people who already have more than they need. Gee, isn't economic growth wonderful? We should have a lot more of that. The result is massive environmental damage and an unconscionable wealth gap. A recent United Nations study of the global distribution of asset ownership reports that the richest 1% of the world's adults now own 40% of global assets. The next richest 1% own 11% of those assets. This tiny sliver down at the bottom here represents the 1% of assets owned by the poorest 50% of humanity. Now, this chart is also a proxy measure for the global distribution of power, and that gap is growing at an accelerating rate. Just think, the greater the inequality, the greater the power of the ruling elite to change the rules to accelerate their expropriation of the rest of what remains of Earth's declining wealth. We might ask, how could this happen in a world governed by democratically elected governments? Yeah, right here in Washington, D.C., might be an interesting question. The answer is both simple and alarming. Our world is not governed by democratically elected governments. It is ruled by global financial markets in which financial speculators sit behind their computer screens, exchanging trillions of dollars daily in search of instant unearned profit to increase the fortunes and the power of the richest people on the planet. Money is the only value, and their computer screens reveal nothing of the human and natural consequences of their trades. Now, the financial institutions for which these traders work buy and sell the largest corporations, devastate national economies that fall temporarily out of favor, and bring down governments that displease them. Together, they create a giant casino in cyberspace that facilitates speculation, financial manipulation, accounting fraud, and the formation of monopolies by the unscrupulous who seek self-enrichment free from the burden of making any beneficial contribution to society. It is a form of grand theft that cultivates a culture of greed and excess. These institutions, furthermore, are often headed by obscenely compensated psychopaths who are psychologically incapable of moral behavior. Their primary business is to increase the wealth gap, and they rule the world. Well, it's about time to bring an end to this insanity, wouldn't you say? And the key to ending it is birthing a new economy based on the truth that we each know in our heart, that healthy children, families, communities, and living systems are the true measure of real wealth, and that mutual caring is the primary currency of healthy families and communities. To increase real wealth, we must invest in growing the social capital of caring relationships and the natural capital of healthy ecosystems. To end poverty and heal the environment, we must reduce wasteful and destructive consumption, and we must reallocate material resources from the rich to the poor to secure for every person their rightful share of the resources on which all our lives depend. In this process, markets have a vital role. But to function efficiently, markets must have rules to secure community interests by internalizing costs, maintaining equity, and favoring human-scale local businesses that honor community values and serve community needs. There is no technology fix for our crisis. We cannot shop our way to salvation. Nor will marginal policy adjustments suffice. We must rethink ourselves and the way we live. Here are five elements of a transformational policy agenda I believe we must embrace if we humans are to have a future. Equity. We must reallocate income and ownership from rich to poor to secure democracy, justice, and a means of livelihood for everyone. cooperation. We must replace global competition with global cooperation, end war as an instrument of national policy, decommission military forces, retool the arms industry for peace, and end the global arms trade. War is a counterproductive response to current security threats. There are no consequential benefits, and the costs are unconscionable in a resource-scarce world. Living capital. Retired GDP is a measure of wealth and progress. Learn to base our investment decisions on returns to human, social, and natural capital. Place a confiscatory tax on profits from financial speculation. Local self-reliance. Strive for local self-reliance in food, energy, and other basic essentials. Localize economies and create compact communities comprised of multifamily homes built to green building standards connected by public transportation to minimize energy needs, auto use, and dependence on foreign resources. Jerry suggests buying a used car. I suggest getting a bicycle. I incidentally just got an electric power boost for my bicycle, and at 70 years old, it makes me feel like a kid again, and I now just leave the car in the garage, and we bicycle every place around our island. This fifth element is a really difficult one that could be the subject for a whole conference in itself, but it's the agenda of bringing forth or creating a system of debt-free money. To turn ourselves from a debt-dependent money system in which banks create money by lending it into existence for private profit to a debt-free credit money system in which governments create money by spending it into existence for public projects. This is an issue that deserves enormous study and attention because once you go beneath most all of our social and economic dysfunctions, it traces right down to the fundamentals of the money system. But it would take far too long to get into that, and Jerry gives me only 18 minutes. Anyhow, these proposals are breathtakingly audacious in the current political context. Simply to propose them is an act of heresy in this political context. Yet each is essential to human survival, and we have to find the courage to speak such heresies with increasing clarity and confidence. We must get these policy agendas on the table for discussion. In closing, in these turbulent and often frightening times, it is essential to regularly remind ourselves that we are in fact privileged to live at the most exciting moment of creative opportunity in the whole of the human experience. The future is in our hands. Now is the hour. We have the power to turn this world around. We're the ones we've been waiting for. Thank you.
David Portin, author of Life After Capitalism and other books, speaking September 14th at Confronting the Global Triple Crisis Conference, will broadcast the conclusion of that panel next week.
This is a song about a very militant social movement that had its golden age in the beginning of the 17th century. Come all you sailors near and far, you honest men know who you are. All of you who dare be free, combine with us upon the sea. Together we will drink a toast, ride the wind on down the coast, see the merchant shipped aboard, raise a jar and swing a sword, watch to see the merchant captain crying when they see the black flag flying. The war with Spain is over now, no more Jack over the bow. We fight for no one but our class. We're gonna kick some captain's ass. All you who'd live before you die, come give an honest life a try. Sail beneath the skull and bones, pay no heed to crowns and thrones. No more greedy princes lying when you come sail with a black flag flying. No more whips and no more chains. To live free or die is what remains. If life is too short either way, you might as well live free today. All for one and one for all, we'll board the ship and make the call. Join us, all you good men, and have your liberty again. Watch the crew now leave their captain frying as they come sail with a black flag flying. Flying Robert's brave and true, and Mary Kelly's gallant crew. Seems to me the world is ours. Watch as the mighty Navy cowers. We have no nation but the sea, no creed but that we will live free. Loot and burn all that we can, that's run by a dishonest man. Their end is near, there is no denying. When they see the black flag flying, I could predict the future, then I would. But all I know is this is good. 1720 is the year. There is nothing left to fear. We may live or we may die. Perhaps our destiny is nigh. I don't know what the end may hold, but I know these ships are filled with gold that was stolen from the poor as we lay dying. So let us sail with a black flag flying.
In our reading last week from Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006, she explained the irreconcilable interests between the capitalist class and the working class, and thus the limitations of what unions can achieve as long as they accept the basic premises of capitalism. She asserts, we must decide which side we're on, which poses a particular challenge for the middle class that tends to vacillate. We ended that section as she promised to examine the question of which class best represents the interest of humanity, and we'll begin with that. Let's examine which class best represents the interest of humanity, starting with a class in power. More of the same? Despite having all the resources of society at its command, the ruling class is incapable of solving basic problems for two reasons. Seize the surplus and compete or die. Because these two commandments rule society, problems become important only when there is profit to be made or when a threat to profit must be averted. Nothing else matters. Consider how the capitalist class responds to epidemics. The HIV/AIDS epidemic emerged in the mid-1970s in Africa, where it fed on widespread poverty and the devastation of war. Although the disease is preventable and treatable, the rulers of the world have failed to devote sufficient resources to solve the problem. By 2005, more than 20 million people were dead, a further 40 million were infected, and more than 12 million children have been orphaned. As the epidemic continues to grow, the U.S. Council on Foreign Relations warns, quote, the scale and geographic scope of the HIV/AIDS pandemic has only two parallels in recorded history, the 1918 flu pandemic and the Black Death in the 14th century, close quote. In 1996, a potent combination of antiviral drugs caused a sharp drop in the number of people dying from AIDS in the United States. In 2003, the World Health Organization, WHO, launched a campaign to provide this new treatment to half of the 6 million people in the world with AIDS. Unfortunately, the rules of capitalism do not allow people to be given the medicine they need. They have to buy it. WHO raised enough money to buy treatment for only 1 million people. To protect drug company profits, 5 million people were left to die. In a vicious cycle of deprivation and disease, capitalism increases inequality. Inequality creates the conditions for disease, and the refusal to invest in human health contributes to the spread of disease. As the pandemic grows, the response of world leaders continues to be haphazard and ineffective. Stephen Lewis, United States Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS, expresses a frustration felt by many. Quote, "People are dying at a rate of 3 million a year, and we have the capacity to keep them alive, and we can't summon sufficient resources." Close quote. The response to future epidemics will be no different. As Mike Davis points out, quote, "The threat of avian influenza maps with uncanny accuracy the global topography of inequality, debt, and poverty. Like HIV/AIDS, avian flu is a plague that grows directly out of the new ecology of globalization, the world public health crisis, and the obscene misallocation of resources by global capitalism." Close quote. Environmental destruction. The only thing constant about life on Earth is change. 200 million years ago, a giant landmass began breaking apart to form the separate continents we know today. The continents continue to move past each other, creating earthquakes and tsunamis. Volcanic eruptions transport molten rock from the Earth's interior to the surface, destroying and rebuilding the land. The climate alternately cools and warms, covering the planet with ice and then melting it again. Species come into existence, flourish, and then perish. Because Earth has never been stable, survival requires adaptation to changing conditions. Capitalism's disregard for the environment parallels its disregard for human beings. The single-minded pursuit of profit has depleted the ozone layer, raised carbon dioxide levels, produced widespread toxic pollution, and contributed to species extinction. While increasing the environmental challenges we face, capitalism also blocks our ability to adapt to those challenges. A prime example is the devastation caused by Hurricane Katrina. Excessive burning of fossil fuels has warmed the planet and increased the ferocity of hurricanes. Yet measures to protect people are grossly inadequate. A scientist who investigated the design, construction, and maintenance of the levees of New Orleans concluded, quote, "People didn't die because the storm was bigger than the system could handle, and people didn't die because the levees were overtopped. People died because safety was exchanged for efficiency and reduced cost." Close quote. Some people dismiss concerns about global warming on the basis that warming and cooling cycles are part of the planet's history. This do-nothing attitude is dangerous. Human beings can adapt to change only by paying attention to what is changing and planning how to respond. The ruling class blocks both responses. The first instinct of public officials in any crisis is to cover their butts. The collapse of the World Trade Center on 9/11 released a million tons of toxic dust, including 2,000 tons of asbestos. The Environmental Protection Agency denied there was any problem, falsely reassured the public that the air was safe, and failed to conduct an adequate cleanup. While public officials shirk their responsibility, they place inordinate emphasis on individual responsibility. The public is lectured to reduce, reuse, and recycle, while the ruling class does the opposite. Merchants push us to buy goods that are designed to break down or become obsolete, so we will keep on buying. Recycling at the point of production happens only when it is profitable. Individuals are condemned for littering, while employers dump on a massive scale because dumping is cheaper than safe disposal or recycling. Between World War II and 1970, the U.S. military dumped millions of pounds of toxic nerve gas and mustard gas, along with 400,000 chemical-filled bombs, landmines, rockets, and tons of radioactive water in more than 26 sites off the coasts of at least 11 states. No one knows the exact location of these sites, let alone their impact. Meanwhile, the most toxic material on Earth is flowing from the Hanford nuclear waste dump towards the Columbia River, while the federal government pretends it isn't happening. The capitalist class can't conserve natural resources any more than a hungry bear can be convinced not to eat his dinner. Capitalists treat natural resources like commodities, where greater use brings higher profits. To boost sales, all energy companies offer lower rates to their higher use industrial customers. In 2005, Yankee Gas Services in Connecticut requested a rate increase because customer conservation efforts had caused its profits to drop. Capitalism blocks the development of clean and renewable energy sources. There is no technical reason why solar power chips could not be as plentiful as computer chips. However, the capitalist class prefers that society be dependent on oil and nuclear power for political reasons. Whoever controls oil controls those who need it, and nuclear power plants provide material for nuclear weapons. For those reasons, the capitalist class will never allow alternate sources of energy to replace oil and nuclear power. Challenges are part of life. To survive, we need a social system that helps us to meet those challenges. Capitalism can solve only one problem: how to accumulate capital. By preventing people from solving life's problems, capitalism is leading humanity to extinction. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Descent into Barbarism. The capitalist system works perfectly for what it was designed to do: accumulate capital. The cost of this single-minded obsession in human terms is barbarism. The more capital accumulates in private hands, the more civil society breaks down. While the majority of people scramble to survive, the two items that dominate world trade are drugs and weapons. Barbarism is expressed in the enslavement of human beings. In the 21st century, more than 12 million people work as slaves, generating over $30 billion a year in profit. Barbarism is revealed in mass deprivation. 40% of the world's population have no access to clean water, and half the world's children live in extreme poverty. In 2003, more than 50 nations were worse off than they were 10 years earlier. Life expectancy is plummeting in AIDS-plagued nations, erasing decades of progress. Instead of producing life-saving medicines, scientists create chemical and biological weapons. Barbarism is marked by growing investment in means of destruction. The United States is the world's leading arms exporter, selling $6 billion worth of weaponry in 2003 alone. Nearly $1 billion worth of those weapons went to nations torn by civil war. According to the World Policy Institute, quote, 20 of the top 25 U.S. arms clients in the developing world in 2003, a full 80%, were either undemocratic regimes or governments with records of major human rights abuses, close quote. Barbarism is undeniable in the trampling of civil rights, secret prisons, systematic torture, and the preference for force over negotiation. America claims the right to attack any nation or government that threatens its interests. A Pentagon document leaked to the Los Angeles Times listed seven nations against which the U.S. would be prepared to use nuclear weapons: China, Russia, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Syria, and Libya. The document also outlined four possible scenarios where the U.S. should be prepared to press the button: in an Arab-Israeli conflict, in a war between China and Taiwan, in an attack by North Korea on South Korea, and in an attack by Iraq on Israel or another neighbor. Those who doubt the willingness of the capitalist class to destroy the future should look at its readiness to destroy the past. Iraq, called Mesopotamia by the ancient Greeks, is known as the cradle of civilization because its culture dates back more than 7,000 years. In The Smash of Civilizations, Chalmers Johnson describes the greatest cultural disaster of the last 500 years. Quote, on April 10, 2003, in a television address, President Bush acknowledged that the Iraqi people are, quote, the heirs of a great civilization that contributes to all humanity, close quote. Only 2 days later, under the complacent eyes of the U.S. Army, the Iraqis would begin to lose that heritage in a swirl of looting and burning, close quote. The National Museum in Baghdad was robbed of its ancient treasures. The museum's entire collection of ancient writings was stolen, including the earliest writings ever discovered. The torching of the National Library and the Library of Qurans destroyed 1 million books and 10 million ancient documents, all irreplaceable. More than 10,000 important archaeological sites in Iraq remain unprotected. How could such a disaster happen? The illegal trade in antiquities is the third most profitable international trade item, after arms sales and drug smuggling. Before the U.S. invaded Iraq, American scholars, museum directors, art collectors, and antiquities dealers met with Pentagon officials who reassured them that Iraq's historical sites and museums would be protected. However, a group of New York-based collectors and dealers lobbied Washington and the Pentagon, arguing that more private trade in Iraqi artifacts would provide the best security for them. When the invasion of Iraq began, the only building that the U.S. forces actually defended was the Ministry of Oil. As American troops watched, the world's cultural heritage was torched by vandals and looted to stock the vaults of rich collectors. Closer to home, a jewel of American culture, the city of New Orleans, was also destroyed when the people in power did nothing to protect it. The question we need to ask is not whether the capitalist class can save humanity, but who will save humanity from the capitalist class. I've been reading from the book Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. We'll continue with the reading next week. In the meantime, you can obtain the entire book in various ways through the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. Over the coming weeks, we'll be reading the book together, and at the end I'll be interviewing Dr. Rosenthal and asking her my questions and any questions you care to submit. I really encourage you to do so, and thanks to those of you who have already sent in questions through the email link at the Unwelcome Guests website, unwelcomeguests.org, where you can download MP3s and podcasts of this and all previous episodes of the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my